Hello everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. This is Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And with me is, as always, my illustrious co-host,
Sean T. Collins. I am a television critic for various publications, including Rolling Stone, Vulture, the New York Observer, and as of this week, the New York Times, and at several places I cover Game of Thrones. I am the co-author of the official annotated A Game of Thrones with series editor Ann Grohl and Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and The World of Ice and Fire. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones weblog located at BoiledLeather.com, which is the humble host of this podcast. And we're very excited for today's episode because it's the continuation of a series that we did one of an awfully long time ago now, but finally we were able to put another Blah Salon together. The ideas were just having various luminaries from other fields come in and talk to us about their work and the books and the show and how those things interact or whatever. And so we're very pleased for our guest today. It's Jason DeMarco. Jason is the Senior Vice President and Creative Director for Adult Swim On Air. So he's responsible for anything on Adult Swim that's not a show. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep.
And he's the co-creator of Toonami, which is the anime programming block. And you have stuff to do with the music, too, right?
Yeah. I am also the musical director for Adult Swim, but that's not really a real title. That's just what my boss calls me.
Okay. So how I guess, you know, I feel like there's probably a fairly decent crossover between Game of Thrones people and just, you know, fantasy people in general and Adult Swim. And, you know, I'm curious as to your background, like, you know...
My background in terms of a fantasy fan or just...
Or both, like, you know, growing up, what were you into that got you to this, you know, to this career path?
Sure. I was born in 71, so I'm definitely a child of the Star Wars era. And then, of course, as I was maturing, I was growing up in the 80s when, you know, good fantasy in terms of filmed fantasy was pretty hard to come by. You had Dragon Slayer and stuff like that. But for the most part, I was just excited to see any fantasy at all. So if I'd be in the theater for Krull or like any old nonsense, you know? I definitely think my first real exposure to written fantasy was, of course, Tolkien. And I remember my library where I lived and I was an indoor kid, shocker. And my grandma used to take me to the library and I took out this big illustrated edition of The Hobbit that was all stills from the Bakshi film.
Ooh, okay.
And I became obsessed with it and I stole it from the library and then read all Tolkien. And, you know, as a kid, of course, so it all started there. And I collected the gnomes books, if you guys remember those, from the Rhyne-Portvliet gnomes books.
Yep.
And I was also a blossoming, I wanted to become an illustrator, so those books kicked off my desire to, like, draw fantasy creatures and stuff like that. So I ended up just doing a lot of reading of fantasy novels, like, and I moved on to the, you know, you move on to the Sword of Shannara, and, you know, I just sort of, I've read most of the big ones that everyone's read who likes fantasy. So it's been since pretty early on, and of course that desire to be in another world and to play in other worlds definitely informed my decision to work in television, because I wanted to be in some way connected to making stories or telling people about stories, because to me that was what enriched my childhood.
The interesting thing to me about, you know, your career arc is I feel like Toonami has been, you know, an extraordinarily influential aspect of what Adult Swim is. And I mean, I've written at length about how influential Adult Swim is in general. But, like, Toonami, it's like, as its own thing, injected a lot of that material into the culture in a way that I think, you know, around the same time, I think, that the Lord of the Rings films and Harry Potter started injecting fantasy into the culture in a big way. And, like, there's a parallel there. And I was wondering, like, how did you, you know, how did Toonami come about? Like, what's the origin story there?
Toonami came about because I graduated from college in 96. And while I was at college, I met a guy named Sean Akins. And he, at the time, worked for TNT. And I was about to graduate, and we were kind of friends, and I just straight up asked him. I said, can you hook me up with a job? And he said, well, move to Atlanta when you graduate and look me up. So I said, all right. So I moved to Atlanta, called him, and he said, well, good news. I'm leaving TNT to go work at Cartoon Network, and I think I can get you a job at TNT, or I can at least get you an interview. So he got me an interview. I did the writing test. I got a job at TNT. I worked there for about 3 years making promos, but at the same time, Sean was asked by our boss, Mike Lazo, to come up with a block of kids' action programming to replace what was there in the afternoon hour currently, which wasn't doing well. So Sean and I, while I worked at TNT, I would walk downstairs and brainstorm with Sean about what this block of cartoon programming could be, and came up with the name Toonami. And we both knew we wanted it to be reflective of – so we felt like kids' cartoons talked down to kids, and it was always about screaming guitars and selling toys. Mm-hmm. We both were excited about anime, and we both wanted to bring more of what we felt was the quality storytelling and animation that anime had to the U.S., in addition to other, like, American cartoons. And we wanted it to reflect what the music we listened to, which was hip hop and drum and bass mostly at the time. And we wanted just to create a block of cartoons for people like us who liked the things we liked, who happened to be younger.
Right. Right.
So it officially started in 97, and, it was canceled in 2008 and came back in 2012, which is another whole story. But so, yeah, it's been about almost 20 years I've been working on Toonami, which is just crazy to think about.
Just one follow-up question right there. When you said you had to do a writing test, what exactly did they test, just out of interest?
Well, the writing test back then, it's a little different now, but basically they give you a packet and they also give you they have you come look at promos and packaging and elements of on air, and they tell you what the network's quote unquote voice is, and then they have samples of scripts for promos and scripts for what they call menus and just different on air elements are, and they have you write five or six for, like, they're like, okay, the next one is a John Wayne movie, so write a promo for this John Wayne movie, and you're supposed to just try to match their voice. The Adult Swim one is a little different, but it's basically just a way of seeing, can you write at all, or is this really just you're just going to throw words out there? Like, it's because writing promos is a weird thing, and it takes a bit of, you know, writing promotional copy that doesn't sound crappy takes a long time.
And that, I think, is such a big part. I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, obviously, but the Adult Swim identity. I mean, Adult Swim has an identity, you know, and it's because of the promos, you know, in large part, I think, which is, I think, a different way, or just, I don't know if it's different, because obviously every network tries that, but it just seems like more effectively done the way you guys do it.
I think for us, it's just sort of the idea that you don't want to bore the viewer, and you don't want to talk down to the viewer. You don't want to assume... It's, you know what it is? It's really just putting yourself in the viewer's shoes and going, why should I give a shit about this? I'm just an average person. Why should I pay attention? And I think as long as we're always remembering, we're not that awesome. You can't assume, like, no one should assume that their audience is automatically going to accept whatever it is that they're selling. And so you have to sort of give them a reason why they should care. So it's really just an idea that we should be transparent about what we're doing and not talk down to people or assume that our dumb jokes are funny when they're not, because we're making them, you know?
Right.
And I think most people in media, and I would go beyond television, don't do that. Certainly not at a network television level.
Yeah.
So I think that's all down to our boss, because he taught us. He taught me for sure. He does it every week. Every week I show him something and I'll think it's awesome, and he'll go, "Why the hell would anyone care about that?" And I'll go, "Oh, you know, you're right." And I'm somebody that's been trained to think that way, and still I fall into the trap, because it's just very easy work ultimately, and it's very easy to get complacent.
Could you have any example of something that you brought up, thought was pretty cool, and then got, I don't know, beat down? I'm just trying to get this a little bit more visual here.
I mean, like, it's more smaller details. So they'll be like, for example, I did a promo for this show called Decker, right? And it's a sort of ridiculous, making fun of like guys like Steven Seagal. It's making fun of overly patriotic, jingoistic American wannabe badasses, right? So I wrote a script that was trying to be from the point of view of the guy who wrote the show, as if the guy who wrote this show was also writing his own promo. And I thought it was really funny, and I showed it to my boss, and he said, and he just basically did what I should have done. He said, "Yeah, but if you don't know anything about this show, you're not even going to know that this is ironic. It just sounds like shit copy. You have to find a middle ground between actually sounding like shit and sounding like shit in the way that this show would want you to sound like shit," which is like some super inside baseball stuff. But since you asked,
okay.
Yeah, that's I feel like that's probably a unique challenge to, like, because that's a Tim Heidecker joint, and that stuff is that's a difficult line to navigate, or something like Check It Out with Dr. Steve Brule, that's older now, so, or at least more in the public eye. So
those are definitely difficult to navigate, especially since the creators are usually involved, or we ask for their opinion of our work so that they can give comments and be happy with it. So, which is again something we do differently from other networks.
Now, the thing that strikes me the most talking to you is that if you got involved with television in 1997 or so, or that's when Toonami started initially, the amount of change that has happened in every conceivable way to this medium in the subsequent 20 years is just mind-boggling. I don't like. Yeah. It's hard to even know where to begin. Like, whether you're talking about the quality of the material, or the amount of the material, or the method by which people watch it, it's all like a completely different animal. Like, what is the biggest difference, between now and when you started in TV?
I mean, the biggest difference. There's so many, it's hard to say, but I mean, practically it's easier than ever to make something, but it's harder than ever to get anyone to care about it. So I think that there's more television, period, than ever before. There's more good television, in my point of view, than ever before. But there's also less money to make all of it than ever before, because people don't want to pay for stuff, and streaming cuts into certainly broadcast networks' profit margins. So it's weirdly easier technically to make things than it's ever been, but harder to get them distributed into the world and make a living off of them. Of course, the big shows, you can still get totally rich, but it was a different ballgame in 97. now it's great. We don't have tapes. The tools to make everything we make are available with pretty much any laptop and consumer grade camera. Like, the means of production are definitely much more within the grasp of anyone that has an interest in doing this. But the means of distribution is still pretty damn difficult unless you're Louis C.K.
How can you seize the means of production?
I don't know. I mean, I think that we're still seeing traditional television models are there. It's still in free fall right now. So it's not as bad as the music industry. People like to, ring the bell for TV being dead, but that's not at all true. Cable subscriptions are still doing just fine. The difference is, that model is still very much in flux, and I don't think where streaming is now is where it's going to be in 5 to 10 years, and we talk about this at work all the time. What's going to happen in the next 10 years? We have no clue. We just know that definitely the way people are watching things is changing and how they're getting their media is changing. And I think to the degree that you might seize the means of production, it's going to be tech disrupt. But, you know, so far tech disrupt hasn't really helped. It's helped viewers have more choices and access. But in the end, like, even if you wanted to say, oh, I'm a cord cutter, I don't want to pay for cable. If you want to get every show that's out there, you're still then going to pay for Hulu, Netflix. If you like anime, you're going to pay for Crunchyroll. You're going to pay for HBO Go. You're going to pay for Showtime. And when you add all those bills up, you're going to get close to your cable bill. So consumer-wise, you are more able to watch things in a more convenient way, but it's not really costing you less unless you're willing to look at less or you're willing to steal. And I think it's going to be some time before some model comes out that is cheap and easy to use, but also doesn't require, you know, people stealing. I just don't know. I really don't.
Yeah, for years the dream, of course, was that cable would go, you know, you could a la carte, and it's like, yep. Well, now you kind of can do that, but you're paying for each individual thing. You know, it's exactly. Not like you said, it's not saving you any money because you're Amazon, Hulu, Netflix, you know, the individual network sites that charge you, like, it's as time goes on, I feel like that's only going to become more and more common. Where
absolutely,
yeah.
And it's what's happening with music now. You know, an album will come out, mm-hmm. and Apple paid for it to be an Apple exclusive. So if you don't have Apple Music and you're a Spotify user, you either got to wait 6 months or steal it.
Right.
So how many people actually have several subscriptions, you know, like Amazon Prime and Netflix? Is this really a big crowd?
From what, you know, again, I'm not in research, but I see research all the time. And from the data that I look at, the vast majority of Americans still get most of their TV from cable or satellite subscriptions. Then there's another segment that is growing. It's like a third of the audience, which is pretty huge, that has a subscription to at least one or more streaming services, and whether or not they use them as a supplement to their cable viewing or as a standalone, I don't know. I personally like my own habits, since I'm in media and I want to be up on everything and I enjoy watching television as a viewer. I have a satellite subscription, a Netflix subscription, Amazon Prime, Hulu, Crunchyroll, HBO Go, and probably one or two I'm forgetting about. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes buy shows on iTunes when I'm traveling and I'm going to be on a plane. So I'm an example of a person who wants the freedom to watch TV, whatever show I want, whenever I want to. But I understand that means I'm going to have to pay through the nose to do it.
Yeah, that's really kind of no way around. Well, I mean, there is a way around it, which is stealing
like you
said. Yeah. I don't know. This is a good transition, because obviously you like Game of Thrones. That's a show that you enjoy watching. Yes. Now, but were you into the books too, or first?
Yeah,
or?
I was the book snob guy. I came into the books at A Clash of Kings, and I finished A Clash of Kings like 3 months before A Storm of Swords came out.
Okay.
So I would say I came on board right at the very end of not a lot of the people knowing about it. Because really, I might be wrong, but in my mind, A Storm of Swords was really where those books kind of broke into a wider consciousness. I know they were bestsellers before that, but to me, it seemed like A Storm of Swords was everywhere at bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I had been reading the books since then, and very much love, I you know, he's a messy writer, but I love those books and I love the characters. So when the show started, I was definitely one of the people that was like, how are they ever going to do the grandeur of this justice, you know, in terms of just making it look and feel right, let alone all the different characters and all the complexity. And they've done a pretty damn good job.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you feel, because Believe me, Stefan and I hear all the time from people who could not feel more strongly that they have not done that. So I'm curious, what makes you, like, why does it work for you as a person who is, I mean, you go back further with the books even than I do. I read the books before the show came out, but I think one of the reasons I read them was I had heard that HBO might be making a show of them. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. Sopranos with swords. That sounds right up my alley. What a great idea. That was the impetus to get me to read them. So you go way far back, and like, what is it that works about the show for you as a book reader?
I mean, for me, I think I will say the first couple seasons for me were rocky. I always looked at it as a solid B show and never an A show, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I really only started looking at it as an A show till the last three or four seasons. Obviously, there were certain episodes. Yeah, I mean, that one, the Assault on King's Landing episode, I can't remember the name of that episode, but that obviously stuck out to me as, wow, these guys are... Like, to me, that was Blackwater, one of the first moments I thought, yeah, Blackwater. I thought, wow, when they can really focus and give you all the little things that are happening at once during one of these huge set pieces, this is television like I have not seen before in terms of scale. But I think they did a really good job casting. I think that's one thing. I think casting Daenerys was probably very challenging, and they really struck gold with her. Mm-hmm. And I think honestly, the whole family, they cast really well. I'm still sort of on the fence about Robert Baratheon. I don't really like the guy that played him.
But really?
Yeah, I did. I pictured him more. I know he was in decline, but I couldn't picture that actor as ever being a big burly dude who would swing an axe around.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing there is, like, we remember what he was like when he was young because we've seen the full Monty, you know.
And yeah,
he wasn't some like behemoth, you know. Right. He was just like a roly poly guy back then too. So it is a little bit hard to imagine.
But I didn't know the actor before I saw the series.
Oh,
so
okay.
I guess I don't have that disconnect because of that. Perhaps, I don't know. Yeah.
But I mean, I think they did a great job casting, and I think that their costuming and everything, the way that they've kept it from going too far off into fantasy land and kept it, you know, they very much, especially in the early seasons, tried to stick with the medieval feel. And I think that really worked because it sort of keeps it grounded. And they've done a very good job, I have to say, of paring down the multiple trillion zillion subplots. Of course, some of them got away from them, but I think for the most part, they did a good job of saying, well, this character's not that integral to this thing. You know, my beef used to be when they would add stuff, when Benioff and Weiss would add things on their own, I would not like what they would do. And now I feel different because they're off books now entirely, and I think it's been a great season.
Yeah, I think the last few seasons have been... you know, a high watermark for the show. I've always enjoyed it. You know, it's funny going back and rereading early reviews where I was like much more lukewarm about things than I am now. But I think part of it is that at this point, starting towards the end of season 5, you have, even book readers have that sense of the unexpected that I feel is really important to a lot of the great shows of this era of television. Not that, yeah. You know, people make, especially critics, have this ongoing battle about spoilers and whether it's important or not. And that's not really what I'm even talking about. It's just sitting down and not knowing what's going to happen is like a huge part of the emotional fabric of watching The Sopranos or Mad Men or Breaking Bad or The Wire or The Americans now, you know, really any show. And as much as I enjoyed Game of Thrones when it was really just seeing like how they did things that I knew were going to happen, much more riveted, I guess is the word, now that I don't, you know. Not that I need to be shocked every time, but it's just nice going into something cold, you know.
Oh, no, I feel the same way. It's very nice to not know for a change, you know, because before... You wouldn't know how exactly they were going to get you there, but you knew that there were some tentpole moments like Ned Stark being, you know, murdered or the Red Wedding. You knew that those moments were going to have to happen, And the whole show isn't those moments. It's much more than that. But I do think, I agree, it's been way more fun for me not having any clue beyond very generally what's going to happen with Arya and the faceless men, you know, that kind of thing. Like, it's right. been great. Me.
Right. I'm trying to think how to phrase this, but I mean, you know, obviously there's been this big boom in drama in particular. And, you know, although I've made the argument that I think similar things have gone on in animation and comedy, you know, with animation in particular under the radar. But like, do you, you know, as a person who works in television and helps make television, like, how much does the success of other stuff affect what you do? Like, do you get a sense of like, oh, we've got to, you know, the bar has been raised, we've got to meet that? And does that also cut across like genres or formats? Like, when you watch a great drama or when you watch a really funny, you know, more traditional sitcom, right. do you think like we've got to fucking compete with that in some way, even if it's a different length, a different format, a different, you know?
I definitely think that that happens, but it's only from genre to genre. I think that for the most part, when I or my colleagues look at a show like Game of Thrones or Better Call Saul or some, you know, some great drama, we just get it. We're just like regular viewers. We're just excited about what's going on with the shows. And then it's, you know, to some degree, admiring of what they're achieving. But we don't look at it as we've got to raise our bar, because weirdly, comedy is such a specific thing and a very hard thing in and of itself, that it's really just you're judging what you're doing by what other people in comedy are doing. And there are occasionally shows or, you know, even comedians who do work that you think, wow, we have to, like, they're just really good. You know, you're not even thinking I got to beat them or I have to rise to what they're doing. You're just thinking that's so great. Or, you know, you might see a show on another network and go, how did that end up on this network? That belongs on our network. I mean, that's kind of how I feel about Nathan For You.
You know? Yeah.
No offense to Comedy Central, but I feel like that show belongs on Adult Swim, and I'm angry that it didn't get on Adult Swim. I have no idea how or why it ended up at Comedy Central, but when I watch Nathan For You, that's one of the few shows I get jealous about. I wish we had that show, or even Review would be another one.
Right.
Because I also think we know how to handle those shows better than some other networks do, because that we specialize in weird shows that confuse people.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, with other comedies we do, yeah, I think so.
What about other, like, you know, what about animation? Because I feel when I did the piece on tracing the influence of Space Ghost, you know, and therefore Adult Swim through the rest of television, you know, I feel like the stuff that was pioneered on an Adult Swim, you know, is now evident, you know, both in Cartoon Network proper and then, you know, tons and tons of other channels, Comedy yeah. Central and Netflix and Fox and... is that something that you pay,
you know,
attention to? Okay.
I think everyone at Adult Swim sees, you know, we were very thankful that you wrote that piece, because you're one of, you know, people don't really, Americans don't care so much about animation. Even the ones that love, even if you love The Simpsons, or you love BoJack, or you love whatever animated show you love, most Americans still don't look at animation as on the same level as Game of Thrones. And, you know, that's why culturally there's no animated show that has the impact of Game of Thrones, at least not that adults would admit. You know, you've got your Simpsons and your, you know, other shows, but they're just not held in the same cachet. And even when you look at most critics, like, oh, here are the best new shows of the millennium, there's always one or two animated shows that they throw in there, but it's always like the sort of leftover genre, and that's okay. It's just, I just don't think Americans, and especially as a person who works with anime and how much animation is a part of Japanese culture, I see the difference. I just don't think most Americans take animation that seriously in terms of not only the quality of work involved with the actual animation, but in terms of the shows themselves and the level of, you know, how artistic they might be. And that's, I don't think I think anyone that works in animation gets used to that pretty quickly and doesn't really worry about it. And in terms of animated shows on other networks, I you know, maybe it's because I'm an Adult Swim, but I don't see many that I think look as good or do anything as interesting as what we're doing. But I definitely see the influence everywhere, for sure. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that people do interesting things with it that then turn us around and, you know, make everyone at Adult Swim go, oh, wow, we should be doing that, you know?
Right.
I mean, as you said yourself, when you started reading A Song of Ice and Fire, it wasn't really a big thing, and fantasy in general wasn't a genre that anyone would lump in with great literature or anything, and by now it has a huge impact. So yeah. I wouldn't discount the possibility there.
No, I think you're right. I think it could happen. And I mean, you know, The Simpsons is probably the biggest American animated show that's had the most long-term impact, I would say, in the last 20 years anyway. And I think it can happen. I just think it's not as common. But yeah, yes. you're absolutely right.
This actually makes... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
It's just one follow-up about the Simpsons thing. How would you rate the influence of South Park in this list?
I think it depends on who you ask. I think the influence of South Park is more related to, among animation people, it's more related to how quick and down and dirty they were able to, like, how that show basically looks like shit and it doesn't matter, and how they are still able to turn around their shows so quickly and keep them super topical. And part of that is because the animation is not that labor intensive. And that's something that we do as well. So I think their biggest influence is that, I think. Because you know, them not being afraid to take on topical subjects. I mean, I'll be honest, I don't really care for South Park, but I do admire the way they're able to fearlessly take on topical subjects and just say what they're going to say. Whether I agree with what they're saying or not is another thing entirely.
Okay.
Stefan, the thing I was actually going to ask you a question, since Jason and I, you know, are familiar with obviously American culture in terms of its reception of animation. And then Jason in particular, you know, knows how different things are in Japan. What's it like in Germany?
Oh, man. Let me perhaps start with my own childhood and cartoons, because I have to honestly say I'm not that big into animation nowadays, because I simply have no personal connection to anime, and all the other stuff is pretty much a non-factor here. Mm-hmm. There is a pretty vibrant anime community in Germany. But not much else. I think we also have Adult Swim, but I haven't heard of it as a great influence. And back when I was a child, I was obviously watching all the Saturday morning cartoons. And what's really infuriating back then, because there were shows that had arcs, you know, over seasons, and that were aspiring to something great, like Gargoyles, for example, or stuff like that. And back then, you could clearly make out an attitude in TV making that this stuff is only kid stuff, and that it is inherently stupid and doesn't merit any larger thinking about. So what you had, for example, was all episodes thrown out randomly. Even if there was a story arc or anything, they simply didn't care. They threw them out in any order that was somehow convenient, maybe alphabetical, I don't know.
Oh, my God.
But it wasn't taken seriously in any capacity. And in my feeling, but this is really only a very limited perspective, animation isn't that big a factor here.
You know, that kind of ties you saying that it was considered kid stuff, so they didn't even take it serious enough to run the episodes in order. It's obviously not that bad in America, but, you know, I've sort of trollishly complained about animation on Twitter, as Jason well knows, and you know, I think that in America, one of the obstacles facing animation is the sense that it's kid stuff. That even the things that adults really like, whether it's The Simpsons or Pixar or Miyazaki films, you know, to one extent or another, those are meant to be viewable by children, or Adventure Time and Steven Universe and things like that. And, you know, so animation, to a certain extent, faces the same challenge that maybe comics do in some circles still.
Absolutely.
Where, you know, where it's like, well, you know, some of this stuff may be really, you know, some of us, it may be extremely well made and adults may enjoy it, but you're still essentially talking about something that, you know, is intended to be received well by children also. And that always throws me for a bit of a loop, you know, whereas I think in Japan, there's a market and an audience and a whole industry making animation for just grown-ups. It's not for children. You know, it's a cartoon, but, you know, and that does, I'm not even saying that as like, oh, it's not for kids anymore because there's tits or whatever. Like, it's, you know, it's for grown-ups. It's, you know, the same way that The Sopranos is not a show for children. It's for grown-ups. You know, and that is that's a thing that I think in America, that there's something about that. I know rubs me personally the wrong way. I always feel like there's something that seems to fish nor fowl about a lot of this stuff. And one of the things I like about Adult Swim is, I mean, I guess very extremely precocious children can enjoy it. you know, but it was stuff that I didn't start watching until I was in college, you know, and so at least it's, you know, trying to pioneer like a new route for animation to go in America. Yeah.
You know, I think you actually made a good point with the comic comparison, because this is also something that is more or less in the wilderness here. We don't really have a vibrant comic scene, and the graphic novel is basically unheard of. I know practically no person who has ever read Watchmen, for example, or any other halfway prominent graphic novel. Comics really are kid stuff here in Germany. I think it's much better in the US, and of course no comparison with Japan, for example.
But also,
I guess those two relate to each other.
Even in continental Europe, I mean, there's a huge tradition of comics for adults in the Francophone countries in France and Belgium, and then also in Italy. It's interesting that I'm sitting here and I can name a couple of German, you know, graphic novelists or cartoonists, but nothing on the level, you know, with the traditions of Belgium or France or Italy. It's a different.
Germany really hates comics.
That's so strange.
Or has hated them for a long time. It was always really also very cheap kid stuff. You just have to look at traditional Disney stuff, you know, like Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck and all that kind of stuff. Most of the things you got to read in Germany was not Karl Barks, which has some level of sophistication, but it was the cheap mass-produced stuff that they draw in Italy, of all places. They have a real industry there of drawing Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse comics, and those are produced really on the cheap and were thrown on the market in black and white for decades. So this is really, there is no culture at all appreciating it. You cannot study comics in any capacity. It's not part of any university curriculum, much less so in schools. And so there is no ground on which you could build on, I guess.
I'm curious, Jason, do you see a continuity between comics and animation?
I mean, in terms of it not being taken seriously by the same people that take normal, quote unquote, high art seriously. Yes, I think that animation, I think unless you're trying to be funny in the United States, animation is more considered a, quote unquote, low art as compared to, say, making a drama like that's live action. Yeah. If you want to do anything with a cartoon in the U.S. besides make people laugh, if you want to scare people or make them sad, or do action of any kind, it's basically unthinkable in the film community. You definitely can't launch an animated film that is anything but a comedy of some sort.
Right, right.
And on television, it's almost as unheard of. I mean, you have Us, and you have stuff like BoJack, which I think you know, I'm not a huge BoJack fan, but I like that it is unafraid to explore sadness.
Mm-hmm.
It may make for an inert television show at some points, but I love that it's an animated show that is trying not to do the same old thing.
Right.
But
even BoJack is still
quote unquote a comedy.
Comedy. Right. Yeah. Right.
Exactly. It can only explore sadness through the lens of being a comedy that also has that. And I think maybe as the show goes on, it'll do it more and more as it gets more comfortable with shaking off its, you know, shackles of what it's quote unquote supposed to be, or maybe not. But I think that it's slowly, I think the needle in the US is very slowly moving just a teeny bit, but I still think it's considered a sort of low medium. Yeah. And yeah, like you said, in Japan, those boundaries don't exist. Animation and comics, manga, are such a core part of Japanese culture that you read them from birth to death and you watch them from birth to death. And as you age, you will be able to find stuff that you can engage with, whatever that might be at whatever your age is.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to, there's no stigma to, oh, I can't go see an animated film unless I'm bringing my kid, because there are all different kinds of animated films. And I don't, you know, I wish that that richness existed in the US, but I'm just happy that it exists somewhere. And I'm happy that our network or other people that are trying to sort of move that needle are doing okay in trying to do that.
Yeah. Now, here's a question for you. I'm going to take advantage of having you on the show. Like, what would you recommend to a Game of Thrones, a Song of Ice and Fire person in terms of anime?
In terms of anime?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. The Japanese tradition of fantasy is nothing like the European tradition of fantasy. I would say that the European tradition of fantasy, which I place Game of Thrones firmly within, is definitely more medieval in nature. It owes a huge debt to Tolkien almost across the board, and it's usually very much Eurocentric. And I think Japanese fantasy is a little different because there are tons and tons of examples of fantasy anime that sort of base themselves off of Japanese myths and folklore, but not in the way that American fantasy is based off of European myths and folklores, if that makes sense. They will take elements, but then they'll throw in steampunk stuff and there'll be like science fiction stuff. So if you look at Dragon Ball Z, that's a fantasy, right? That's a fantasy show. But it's also got science fiction elements because these guys are from another planet, but they're doing things that no one could ever do. And you could make wishes by gathering balls together and calling a dragon that will grant your wish. I mean, that's definitely a fantasy element.
Right.
So I think for me, what distinguishes the Japanese fantasy shows from more Eurocentric fantasy is that their fantasy is fantasy in a way that almost American viewers don't recognize, because no one has to have swords. No one has to cast spells, but it is still the characters will still be in worlds that don't make sense traditionally. There's a show called Soul Eater that is an anime that I like very much. That's about characters who are basically they're soul collectors, and you have guys that pair up with guys that are living weapons, so they will turn into a scythe when they need to. It's just stuff like that. Like, Japanese fantasy does not adhere to any of the limits of the average European fantasy, and I like it very much for that. And you know, it's world building, but it's really world building from the ground up. It's not world building like, okay, these are our elves and these are our dwarves and these are our, you know.
Right.
You know, you can even, looking at the newest really big anime that's kind of fantasy is Attack on Titan. Mm-hmm. So Attack on Titan is about a sort of somewhat post-apocalyptic world where we don't know why, but giant humans are roaming the earth called Titans. And they're naked and they appear mindless. No one knows why they're there, and they eat people. And Attack on Titan concerns the last city that has not been destroyed by the Titans and how they try to survive fighting the Titans. So there's steampunk elements. there's fantasy in terms of there's no scientific reason for any of it to be happening, but it's not fantasy in terms of where are all my flying dragons.
Right.
So I would say if you were a Game of Thrones fan, you start with a show like Dragon Ball, not to use the most common one, but it's common because it's great, or Attack on Titan, and see the difference in how a Japanese mind approaches fantasy. Because there are elements of their folklore in there, but they're not necessarily direct elements. And even Dragon Ball is based on Chinese folklore. Hmm. So it's like they will take all kinds of elements from all different countries, all different types of Asian folklore, take the most interesting parts and rip them apart and do what they want. Now, maybe it's because their societies have had to in a very real way, they look at some of this stuff as real. Like, you know, culturally in Japan, you know, what your ancestors did and sort of, you know, paying homage to your ancestors and whether or not you do that and what the results can be is still a very real thing. So I think for them, it's a way to deal with all of this past stuff, but in a less direct method. That's my half-assed, you know, point of view as an American who works with anime.
Yeah. You know, I think in the European and American also fantasy tradition, the influence of Tolkien looms so large. Even the fantasy authors who dislike Tolkien, you know, are working in just direct opposition or reaction to him, like Philip Pullman or Michael Moorcock, or, you know, people who talk about how much they dislike Tolkien. You see that influence almost as like a reverse negative, you know. And there's other, you know, obviously there's Lovecraft and there's Robert E. Howard who are friends, but I mean that's easily enough. Fold, you know, there's just this one guy who invented everything, you know,
yeah,
for all intents and purposes, or codified it. And so stuff as wide ranging as, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and Game of Thrones, and it has this sort of texture underneath it. And it sounds like that doesn't exist in Japan. There's no like comparable figure for that genre.
There isn't. I mean, you know, there are certainly incredibly influential figures like Tezuka, but again, right. Tezuka is more like Walt Disney than he is Tolkien. You know, it's not necessarily his one particular story he told. It's more a whole bunch of different innovations that he had and that he brought up a whole bunch of other people and sort of nurtured them. But yeah, there's no one in Japan that sort of laid the blueprint that everyone follows the way that Tolkien laid the blueprint for European and American fantasy.
Yeah. Well, I know. I think it's about time we have to let you go. But I don't know. Now that season six is over, and no one has any clue what the hell is going to happen, I guess a good final question is, what the hell do you think is going to happen?
Oh man. I mean, I think I definitely think they've clearly, obviously set it up so that John and Daenerys will at the very least bring their armies together, I would think. Daenerys might have to deal with Euron's fleet before she gets there. She might have to take King's Landing on her own while Jon holds off the Walkers. I'm not sure. They might team up together and sort of deal with... My thinking is that they will deal with... I'm not sure, though. They might deal with King's Landing and all that first. And then the final season is going to be everybody united who's still alive, or most people united, with the White Walkers sort of being the major threat that they all have to fight back against. I might be wrong, but that makes sense to me. I think that Highgarden and the Sand Snakes are going to prove a big problem for pretty much everybody. And I think that I just feel like they've got to deal with King's Landing first, right? Am I wrong? It feels like they got to deal with that before the Walkers really in earnest start making their way across Westeros.
I think you're probably right insofar as there's nobody left in King's Landing as a foil for Cersei, really. Everyone left in King's Landing is other than Jaime, is like one of her minions. There's no other main characters there. So for there to be any dramatic developments in that entire end of the storyline, you need to just have other people show up to deal with, right? You can't spend another season with just the intrigue in King's Landing. There's no intrigue. Everyone's dead.
it's got to be Daenerys and Tyrion landing, coming to King's Landing, because we have to have Tyrion confronting his brother and sister. I can't imagine they don't at least have him talk to one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
They could bring in the wild card of Euron Greyjoy and simply let him propose to Cersei with his dragon horn or something. Huh. That's a possibility that's out there.
Oh, yeah. True.
Because they introduced him, and since then he's able. So it is possible, especially since the fleet is already on the going, that he will simply somehow end up in there and provide a new angle to King's Landing politics.
Yeah, he's the wild card. I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. Good call, man. Good call. Well, thank
I don't know if it's a good call yet, but we will see.
That's true. Well, thank you so much. I'm glad we were finally able to do this, Jason. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, I had a blast. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And everybody, thank you for listening. Hopefully we'll do more of these episodes, which we really love doing. And they're just, you know, a question of scheduling, you know, but it's been wonderful. And Jason, thanks again. And everybody else, we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.